you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Hey there. I appreciate you for tuning in to Mind Body Peak Performance today and joining me for another journey. I started this show as an exploration into the frontiers of health, wellness, performance, and the sciences, and today's episode will not disappoint. DARPA stands for Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and they're among the most innovative scientific groups in the world, receiving unparalleled funding, access, and some of the brightest minds. Many of today's coolest gadgets, technologies, devices, and tools were born in a DARPA lab. Our guest has been behind the scenes at DARPA. Trung Tran is a former DARPA program manager. He earned a BSEE from the U.S. Air Force Academy and an MBA from the Wharton School of Business at University of Pennsylvania. He developed cryptographic chips and advanced command and control networks. Trung received 4 medals for his work in these areas. And now he's spent the last 15 years in Silicon Valley developing some of the most powerful hardware. His expertise includes machine learning, data analytics, and non-conventional computer architecture. As you'll learn in the episode, Trung discovered that the field of human performance and health are ripe for innovation and personalization. And that's exactly what he's doing at his startup Amplio.ai. Buckle up as we go behind the curtain to explore the intersection between AI, human performance, and recovery. This morning, we have Trung Tran on the show. Trung is the CEO of Amplio, and Amplio is a company that's helping everyone around the world avoid burnout. Trung, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate you having me on. I'm very excited to be here.
What non-negotiables or unusual things have you done for your health and performance so far?
You know, I have a couple of issues that kind of help, hold me back a little bit. And so what's non-negotiable is for me to actually, you know, do some exercise every day. I have a personal trainer I go to 3 times a week that I make sure that I don't miss those times, right? But, you know, beyond that, you know, other non-negotiables, try to get at least 3 hours of sleep. You know, sometimes that's hard when you're working, but, you know, sleep's super important. And that's something that I'm constantly working on, but that's something that's important to me as well.
And there's a big overlap between burnout and sleep. And so I'm surprised that you just shoot for 3. I get that you're a busy man, but.
Well, actually, you know, it's different people. I mean, ideally, I wouldn't get 8 hours of sleep, but a lot of people just can't, you know. And, you know, to be productive, you know, sometimes, you get what you can and you kind of sleep in on the weekend sometimes. And so, you know, it's very unrealistic sometimes to say, hey, go 8, 11 hours of sleep. And, you know, if you're independently wealthy and you have tons of time, then maybe you can, right? But if you're kind of person that like likes a little pressure, likes to kind of keep working and enjoys what you do, sometimes sleep is the one that you have to force yourself to do a lot.
Yeah. I'm the exact same way. I have a hard time getting more than 8 hours of sleep. Even 8 hours of sleep is a stretch for me. So right. I feel you there.
Yeah, it's a nice goal, but it's unrealistic. I think it's the question is, how much sleep do you need to remain effective, right? If I don't sleep for 3 days, I'm not effective, right? You know, I'm slurring my speech, you know, you name it, right, kind of thing. Yeah. But if you're, you know, if you don't need that much sleep and you actually get more tired, if you sleep longer, you know, just find the right set for you for your circadian rhythms. That's what we talk to our sleep experts about a lot is understand your circadian rhythms, right, and try to get in tune with them. As opposed to just, you know, having a set number of hours that you need to sleep.
I can't sleep 8 hours because by around 6 a.m., no matter the day, I wake up with energy and it's hard to fall back asleep. And on the weekends, I can really like linger in bed and force myself to, but it's difficult.
And that's your circadian rhythm. Your circadian rhythm says you have to be up at 6, right? And so sometimes, you know, that I early in my career too, you know, I was in the military, so I was up at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, right? And for a long time, I couldn't sleep past 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning because my body had been set to that clock. I've gotten good where I can sleep to 8, 9 o'clock sometimes, depending on how late I slept the day before. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the kind of normal way to your body works, you know? So, you know, it takes a while to retrain your circadian rhythms, yeah. Right? The problem is, you know, a lot of us are very not methodical about our sleep. So one day we get 2 hours of sleep, one day we get 8, one day we get 6. Like even sleeping extra will screw up your circadian rhythm. So to the point that, you know, your body's trying to figure out how much sleep does he need, you know, when does he need to go to bed? And so it's really about not necessarily the amount of sleep, it's about the methodicalness of making sure that you're actually training your body to the right circadian rhythm. And if you do like a lot of weird things, it's really going to screw that up quite a bit.
Yeah, consistency around circadian rhythm is huge. And one of the best things you can do to maintain a stable circadian rhythm is to get outside and get morning sunlight first thing when you wake up. Another thing that I've heard that I like is to figure out how much sleep you actually need, whether or not you're grinding and hanging out 16, 17 hour days, is to go camping. When you go camping and you don't have any artificial stimuli, no phones, no screens, just you with the campfire, maybe in the night sky, then to see how your natural circadian rhythm is when you wake, when you sleep.
That's actually a great idea. I mean, I think, you know, if you can actually, like, you know, de-stress your mind, like, you know, maybe even meditation before you go to bed, I think it's the same kind of thing where you're just completely relaxed. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. So tell me about your background. How did you get started with health and performance?
Yeah. So, you know, I was working at DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Project Administration, kind of DOD's kind of leading edge in research. And we were looking at next generation of AI. So, I mean, today what you see is a lot of what I call first generation AI. AI is allowed to go see things. Second generation AI is kind of predicts things, right? And the third generation AI kind of helps you make decisions and different courses of action. And so, okay, people really need advice, right? And we said, you know, we need to build AI systems can do that. And we said, okay, where in most people's lives do they get the worst amount of information? Mm-hmm. And really it's around health and fitness, right? I mean, when you look at all the stuff out there, regards to coconut water or keto or this and that, there really is no one answer to anything, right? Then, you know, when we talk about medicine, talk about precision medicine, they say something called epigenomics, your environment and your genes affect how medication works for you or doesn't work for you. And it's all very unique and individualized. And I think it's funny when we talk about one part of our body, you know, in the medical case, when we're sick, being very specific to us, but we look at fitness and say, okay, everyone needs to do the same thing. It just doesn't make any sense. And so we thought, you know, that's the perfect place where you can actually interject someone, an AI that can actually help people and counsel them to get better.
Yeah. In fitness, so you go into your average gym, or I guess your average track, and actually, I guess track less so than the gym, but you get the same blanket movements, exercises, tempos, reps, sets, all of that. A lot of people find it online and just take that plan and run with it. But each imbalance, everyone has imbalances in their body, and each imbalance and exercise can either help correct or it can exacerbate. And so it's important to figure out your unique body and do the exercises that brings it back into balance and strengthens it.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, the funny thing about our bodies, though, you know, is that we compensate. And our body's like the world's best compensator. So you're injured or you're a little bit, you know, if you have a back injury, you're all of a sudden your leg hurts, right? And so making sure that you, like you said, get back in balance, you can actually localize what's wrong, right? So get yourself back where your body's not balancing. I think it's funny that traditional working out has been like 30 or 45 minutes on a bike or something like that, right? Consistently, you don't change the tempo, you don't change the speed or anything like that. And people wonder why they weren't getting healthy, right? To the first order. And I think that's just funny because, you know, your body gets used to something, it doesn't really try hard. And that's the thing, right? Mm-hmm.
For the other nerds out there like myself, when you were at DARPA, what were some of the other things that you were learning and, I guess, technologies that were revolutionizing things?
I think, you know, we've led a lot with the drones. You know, we created a drone ship, interesting aircraft. I mean, drones, flying drones that actually can fight each other and kind of play chess against each other. You know, there's a lot of technology around trying to help with decision-making in general. For me, you know, our focus is mostly on computers, and one of the things that I found very interesting is that the, and just one reason why it led me to what I'm doing here in Amplio is that the GPU was a mistake. When you look at the big step function in AI over the last, you know, decade or so, right? It was all fueled by the GPU. But the graphics card was made for me to play, you know, Doom, you know, was made for me to play those kind of games. And it just happened to have the same math that, that we needed to do AI, multiply and accumulate. So most CPUs run on an addition scheme, every logic unit, where it just does fancy adds to do multiplication, stuff like that. And so the GPU had a multiply and accumulate block, and that was just revolutionized, changed things. And so, you know, I look and I looked at it and said, there are a ton of advanced AI algorithms out there. Like, for example, the machine learning algorithms you have today have been around since like the 80s. Right, but they're just not computationally feasible to do. Right, machine learning wasn't able. It would cost you over $1 million to run a machine learning algorithm, but with the GPU, it cost you $25K. And so that was a huge change in the dynamics, the economics of AI. And so, you know, looking at what these brilliant professors are doing in regards to math, and realizing that computers are math engines, right, kind of thing. Yeah. You know, I really understanding and learning kind of like what math's out there coming up that we can't compute, and trying to build machines to do that, it was really interesting for me as well.
When I started studying machine learning, I realized that a lot of it is just advanced math and statistics.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's the thing. You know, in the next wave, the way we're working on in AI is probabilistic. Can you actually look at the probability curves and can you say, okay, our estimate of this is the probability of the world, and kind of getting the way out of the way of ground truth. You know, there's like, you know, if 2 + 2 = 4 is a ground truth, that's fine. But in a probabilistic sense, how close you are actually to 2? If the probability is that you're actually a little less than 2, or, you know, in both cases, then you're not going to be 4, right? You're going to be the odds are you're going to be something less than 4. And so, you know, when you get beyond the idea that, hey, I haven't answered everything, I have the odds are good for something to happen, and you want to always increase the odds, right? You don't want to be like Han Solo and say, don't tell me the odds kind of thing. But, but you know, you want to be the type of person that can really kind of think through it. And I think that's really where the next generation AI comes in, is that we're horrible at that. We, as human beings, we have a lot of assumptions, right? And we think the world's going to act a certain way just because, you know, our beliefs or whatever our beliefs are, right, kind of thing. And we don't really look at the odds. We don't actually think, you know, maybe this isn't going to happen. You know, it's supposed to rain today and all of a sudden it doesn't, you know, like, but weather forecasters are stupid, right? The odds are just not there, right? I mean, so that, you know, the odds of something happening, 30% means maybe or maybe not, right? And so I think probability curves are really the next math that probably it's a graph programming. I think Coulter's book was really influential for me. And so when you look at that kind of probabilistic math, it's really kind of the next wave.
So you left DARPA. Which many consider to be the cutting edge of technology and innovations across different domains.
Sure.
To start your own company. What went into that?
Well, you know, when you work at DARPA, you work on a very specific problem, national defense, right? And it's super important. It affects a lot of people, don't get me wrong, right? But I wanted to start a company that helps everyone, right? Beyond just national defense. And when you look at health and fitness, we have the possibility of actually helping 7 billion people on Earth, right? Everyone needs help with, you know, their mental health, their physical health, right? And so how do we help all these people? And I thought that was like, what's really compelling to me is that, you know, the impact we could have. You know, AI should have impact, right? And that's what I really think, so that we can actually make a significant difference in how people feel, how they act. And with mental health being such a huge problem these days, stepping in that arena is really important, and being able to help out there.
So tell me about Amplio.
Yeah, Amplio, we're a small company. We are pre-revenue, so we haven't quite got our product to market yet. We've got some significant pilots. One of them actually was really interesting, is we're doing one with the University of Maryland, where we're actually testing 100 people as they go into work. Now, one of the things with the pandemic is, you know, it's impacted us in a lot of different ways that we may not even understand. Right? A lot of people feel anxious. They, you know, they feel a little less sure. I mean, it can be seen in kind of the job movements that have occurred recently, where people are switching jobs because it's a big event. It's a trauma. And we're going to see if that, how that trauma translates and how we can help people kind of adjust to the new normal. And so we're excited about that. So we have a product that are in people's hands, not quite revenue, but once we finish the pilot with Maryland, the pilot we have with the DOD and one that we're working on with a commercial company, we think we have a good idea of what the market will need and how people use it. And then we think we can go to the market aggressively after that.
Tell me the high level, what does Amplio do?
Sure. So Amplio, you know, what we do is we help you listen to your body. You know, so we use biometric measurements, looking at heart rate, HRV, because not only do you physically have to be well, but your mind affects your body as well, right? We look at your sleep. We're looking at your nutrition. Then we also look at your mind with psychometric surveys and cognitive testing, where we look and say, what's your mental focus today? How much mental energy do you have? What's your mood like, right? And so we're looking to see, okay, what's your body telling you about your current state? Does it say that, hey, Nick's firing on all cylinders and everything's great and he's going to conquer the world? Or does it say, you know, Nick's great in a lot of areas, but he's kind of hurting in this area, right? And being able to identify that to people, say, okay, you know, you have a problem here. It's not very serious. It's something you can address early. And here's some suggestions we have based on our experts in the world. And as you kind of use that suggestion, we will tune it to you so that it becomes more customized to actually what the effect is for you. And we may switch things out depending on what works better for you. But the goal is that, you know, we help you identify what's wrong with you. We give you a routine that's customized and tailored to you, right? And we give you constant feedback where you're making progress. And so when you talk about burnout, you know, most people don't know they're burning out. Most people just think they're enjoying their work or you're just running really hard and they're, you know, just having fun. And then all of a sudden, you know, like, oh my gosh, I'm tired. And why am I doing this? You know, I'm disillusioned, right? And all of a sudden you want to leave the company. And so we want to be able to kind of give employees, the people, the sense of that, right? You know, what's starting to fall apart? What are my habits and what am I doing now that I can change to kind of balance things out more? Maybe I just had a kid and I can't work as hard as I used to, right? How do I balance that stuff out? And a lot of that stuff is amazing, is not what we're taught. No one teaches how to find that kind of balance or teaches to know when we're burning out. And, yeah. You know, I had a boss at Intel. He was a VP. Chris Norris was his name. And he said, Trung, you can be a rocket ship going straight up. You can be one at an angle. He said, you don't want to be the one straight up, because straight up means straight down. Right. His whole point to me is not work weekends, but I was having fun. I was enjoying what I was doing. So sometimes you just don't think about it. Right. Yeah. But you know, that's kind of idea for us. You know, that was really good advice for me when I was younger, and I want to build an app that kind of gives people that same advice. Or, hey, you're really pushing the limit of what you can do. You're not going to be happy regardless of the result. Right. Why don't you back off a little bit? You can still get the results done. And that's really kind of the essence of what we're trying to do here. Something you listen to your body, listen to kind of what's it telling you need help on. Get that help so you can actually manage yourself so you don't burn out.
I like that. It augments the messages of the body, making it easier to learn to listen into.
Yeah, yeah. Because a lot of times we ignore it, right? Especially if you're like really into a project or, you know, you're training for an event and you're really into that training, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's why people get injured, they overtrain, because they're not listening to their body, right? But, you know, with the biometric information we get from wearables and, you know, with the surveys we have, we're always listening to your body, right? And making sure that's at the forefront of what you need to know.
Mm-hmm. So that means you must be on the forefront of like studying and researching all the latest wearables and what's coming down the pike. Tell me about some of the new technologies you're seeing there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We're wearable agnostic. There's $64 billion being spent on wearables, so we didn't think we need to build another one. We think, you know, what we're really excited about is electrodermal analysis, right? That's basically a galvanic skin response where we measure the contents of your sweat, right? And that's pretty good. It's pretty new, revolutionary. It will help understand the amount of cortisol and how much stress you're actually doing, because it actually measures it, as opposed to kind of estimating it from HRV.
Is it just for measuring cortisol?
No, it can actually measure mood. There's other hormones that it looks at, right? But stress is the one that they may actually mostly focus on from that standpoint. The other one that's super interesting is pulse ox, SPO2. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, when you work out or you do compound exercises, you forget to breathe. Remember your trainer always said, breathe. Yeah. And breathe.
Yeah.
Because you're focusing on, like, you know, It's like chewing gum and walking at the same time. You know, sometimes it's hard to do the exercise and breathe at the same time. And so, you know, a lot of times, you know, we get tired and our muscle fatigue occurs faster because we're not breathing, right? And then even during the day, you know, when you're stressed out, your breathing's not consistent, you know? And from that standpoint, that raises your blood pressure because your heart's pumping more often, right? That's like when you get excited, you get hyperventilating, something like that. Everyone tells you to take a breath. Take a moment, take a breath, right? Yeah. That's really to kind of calm down, get your oxygen back into your body, get your brain moving. And so getting a real-time SpO2, as opposed to just going to the nurses, you know, when you go to the doctor, they always stick your finger in that machine, right? Mm-hmm. And to get your numbers there. I mean, it's pretty dramatic. If you're like below 70, you're dead, right? And you know, even if you're like, if you drop below 95, 94, your body's being, you're basically asphyxiated, right? You're supposed to get 98, 99 all the time. That's not true. Obviously, you know, things move in your life, you know, things are happening, right? If you're running really hard, you're going not to breathe as well and not get as much oxygen in your body. And that's when you stop exercising, you're not converting fat to energy because you don't have oxygen.
Yeah. I've noticed that when I do breath work, some different modalities, I can get under 90%, but it's only temporarily.
Right. Yeah, you don't do that too much, but it kind of gets a little scary. But yeah, I mean, that's what you want. I mean, I think, you know, you want to be aware of how well you're breathing, and we don't. We're not going to think about it at all. And I think, you know, since oxygen is like 99% of all your body functions, because it uses it to burn energy and do this kind of things, not getting enough is kind of a serious thing, and people just don't pay attention to it.
It's one of my favorite metrics of the Oura Ring, the respiratory rate at night, because from that you can figure out how taxed you're going to be when you wake up.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, that's the whole point of sleep apnea, is that you're not breathing well, right? And, having some kind of feedback in the machine, sleep apnea is great, but also realizing that, you know, there are a lot of things that may not help, you may not sleep well in because you're under stress or those kind of things. And that does prevent your brain from going to the deep kind of sleep that you really need to re-energize. So, I mean, I think that's super important. And, companies are starting to integrate that into their watches and other wearables, right? So, you know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see all the new gadgets that come out, right?
Let's take a step back now and talk at a high level. If you were to classify all the activities and lifestyle factors into buckets, what would you say that are your pillars of peak performance?
You know, it's interesting. We had a study with Major League Baseball players. I work with a lot of collegiate athletes over the last 3 years, and they're all pretty much at peak physical form, right? And, you know, unless they're injured, you know, they can perform, right? They're at the 98th, 99th percentile. And what we realize is that, you know, just because you're physically able to do something doesn't mean you're mentally or able to do it, right? A lot of times these people, because they're such physical specimens, have never had to actually watch what they eat or watch where they sleep, they just bounce back, right? And so they have some pretty bad habits. And so, you know, mentally, you know, just helping them focus and get their mind in the right area. So I think the mind is the most important thing, because if you can visualize what you're doing and you can actually think through what you want to do or how you perform the act, then you can actually, you know, perform it, right?
So you're an advocate of visualization.
I'm an advocate of visualization. I'm also an advocate of like, you know, just positive reinforcement. You know, when you know, you have to believe. You're not going to do something you don't believe, right? Also very much a focus of routines and focus, where if you have an organized life, right? And you kind of spend less of your mental energy every day trying to figure out what you're going to do next, right? Then you're much better off. Right? You know, when I look at these elite guys and how they kind of manage life, and I look at like executives and stuff like that, the reason why you have an assistant is for mostly to have everything in your life taken care of for you. So you don't have to think about, you don't think about what you're cooking for dinner. You don't have to think about, you know, that's why pre-preparing meals and all that's good, because the less you have to think about those kind of things, the more you can focus on what you're trying to do. And that's usually for a baseball player prepping for the game.
Yeah. And decision fatigue is a real phenomenon.
It's a real thing. Yep. Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, it leads to confusion, and you don't want that kind of cognitive fog in your head while you're trying to do something important.
By the end of the day, it's easy just to kick back and say, oh, well, I'm exhausted. It's been a long day. I'm just going to have this ice cream, or I'm just going to sit back and watch TV for a couple hours because I'm tired.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you just spent your day focusing on what you need to, and you actually will feel a little more refreshed too at the end of the day, right? Because you haven't spent the energy on that, right? I mean, one of the things that we work with Chris Talley, who's a world expert nutritionist, right? He said, you know, the reason why we look at antibodies in food, not that you're necessarily super allergic to it and you're going to get you know, hives or whatever, but every, you know, piece of energy, every calorie you can have, right, should be burnt towards what you need to do. And if your body's producing, you know, white blood cells, antibodies go fight food. Like I was mildly allergic to eggs and milk when I took his test. That's energy is taken away from your body. It's not helping it repair things and do those kind of things. So, and the same thing with mental fatigue, you know, your brain's working on things that don't really matter. And you're, you know, kind of in the back of your head, you're taking away cycles from your brain that could be focused on more important things.
Understanding food sensitivities is more important than allergies, because allergies, you notice very quickly. Right. I get this, I get a bad reaction, I should stop eating this. Simple. But right. The intolerances and sensitivities, it can lead to chronic inflammation. And ultimately, food is information. The microRNA in like real produce, for example, influences your genetic expression, your epigenetics, so that if you're getting the wrong information, your body is not compatible with the food and you continue to ingest it every single day. You right. can just imagine what message you're constantly sending your body.
No, I said absolutely. And that's things like, you know, a lot of the tiredness fatigue we find is that because we've used our brain and we don't think about these things, right? You know, they say, don't think about what you eat and how much your body's being spent, just like you said, reacting to the wrong messages from the food you're eating, right? And it's battling yourself, right? Kind of thing. So imagine, you know, if you can actually not be fighting your own body, be actually, you know, able to clear your mind, you know, how much more relaxed you can be, because, you know, you're taking that percentage of energy away from your total energy in the day. Honestly, you get tired quicker. Right. You're really on a bad food binge and you're eating worse food. You're going to get tired quicker. Right. You know, it's not just tryptophan and turkey. You know, you eat the wrong food, you know, you're going to get tired. And because your body's spending more energy processing it, right, or trying to do something with it than you want. And if you feel tired, then you're not productive anyway, shape or form.
What's next in your list of areas to focus on?
Is emotional stability. People don't really realize that, you know, I call everything in the body kind of an equilibrium system, right? So you take diabetes as an example, right? Your blood sugar is high, right? Because you ate a bunch of food, right? And then your blood sugar is low when your body processes that food into the energy that you need, right? Kind of thing. And so your blood sugar is never stable. It goes up and down depending on what you eat in a day. And it has dramatic effects, you know, depending on when it goes down, when it goes up, and how you feel and how you react, right?
And how high it goes up or down.
Or high it goes up and down, right? Obviously, that's diabetes, right? Because it's unregulated. And the same thing is true for emotions. People don't realize that, right? People think they have to be happy all the time, right? Or that, you know, if they're not happy, something's wrong with them. No, I mean, your body's self-regulating. That's when manic depressives have real problems, because they're too high manic or they're too high depressive, right? They're not cycling back and forth. And so the question is healthy to sometimes feel sad? And I know some of my ex-girlfriends may be thinking back now, like saying, I told you so. But in regards to that fact, right? You know, yeah, it's okay to be sad. It's okay to be, you know, happy, right? You know, the question is, you know, how long are you in one of those cases? And that can be, emotions are kind of like cortisol for nutrients. Cortisol will burn through nutrients faster than anything like exercise. So if you're under a constant stress bubble, you eat your nutrients faster than if you ran a marathon. Right. And same thing with emotional stability. If you are your manic or depressive, or you're on kind of a cycle, you have to kind of correct that, because it burns more of your energy mentally than you would ever believe. Right. You know, and so, you know, it wrecks your overall approach to life, how you look at things. And so I think the next thing is emotional stability. Right. Dealing with things that, you know, upset you, trying not to get upset. Yeah, right. Yeah. How about little things that don't matter? And try to get out of that either the negative or the over-optimistic thing. But again, you got to keep in mind that you regulate. So you got to make sure that you don't beat yourself up if you have a down day, right? Now, if you have a week of down days, then you should do something about it, right?
I've only started learning about and studying emotional health in the last 2 years. And I've noticed that there's pretty much two camps. There's the one camp that sees emotions as either non-existent or not important or completely overridable 100% of the time, signal to be ignored. And the other that says you should listen to your emotions. You shouldn't exert any of your own like autonomy or control over them. You should just like let them be. And if you're down, you're down. You're up, you're up. Like just roll with the punches, basically. And I'm surprised how little overlap there is between the two. And how few people are saying, like, hey, it's good to have some of both. You should listen to them because they're ultimately messages. But at the same time, if you're constantly up and then you crash down and then you spike way back up very quickly, it's going to take a toll on you physically, mentally, obviously emotionally.
Well, that's a lot of where addiction comes from too, right? Medicating and to kind of regulate it, right? And your body stops regulating it. So then, you know, the whole let's not listen to your emotion things is bad, because that's what happens with drug addicts, right? You know, to a certain extent, they're not regulating their emotions anymore because they're medicating to get over it, right? That kind of thing. And so, you know, you do want to listen to your body. You can't just ignore it. But at the same time, you know, you can't be overly, I mean, like I say, you have a string of bad days. You know, if you're a pitcher, you know, you're going on a bad run, you have to start thinking and doing things to kind of change your mood, trying to change how you're doing, because you can't just accept the fact that everything's going downhill, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, that just cascades. And so, you know, I think it's kind of both things where you listen to your body to some extent to make sure that, you know, you are helping the regulation. But the idea, though, you know, we're a chemical machine, right? And so whereas nutrients that feed in hormones that regulate our body, or is like dopamine and stuff that regulates our mind and our emotions, right, kind of thing, your body's producing for a reason, right? And that's, again, why listening to your body is super important, right? Whereas mentally, you feel like you feel depressed or you feel anxious about something, right? And it's producing the hormones that kind of leads to that kind of depression, or you're super happy, right? Yeah. You know, you have to listen to that chemical while your body is doing and really fix what's wrong, as opposed to ignoring it, which is what we mostly do, right? That's the cat you talk about. Just ignore it. You know, I'm in charge of my world. I'm in charge of everything. Yeah. Or, we can listen to it and try to see what we can do to kind of help the body before it gets to the point where we have to medicate, right? Where it's kind of too bad.
Yeah. And your thoughts are electrical signals, and that those electrical signals influence the chemical releases that happen throughout your body.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing. I guess, yeah, your mind, you know, the funny thing is that your mind lives in this virtual world. And so, you know, if you, how it sees your body, how it sees it's doing is how it regulates it, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily always listen to what's really happening in your actual body. So a lot of times people ignore pain. They ignore other things because they're in this virtual world where they decide to discount those things, right? You know, they compartmentalize when they feel sad and they just don't allow themselves to be sad. You know, all those things are things that could potentially be very harmful, because, again, you need to be able to do that regulation. And if you can't regulate, then you can't survive, right? Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things you've learned about performance through DARPA and your experience starting this company?
I think the biggest thing I've learned is there's a separation between skills and abilities. Mm. Skills can be taught, right? I mean, I think, you know, you may never be Michael Phelps, but you can learn how to swim really well, right? You can learn the skills and mechanics of it all. And that a good coach would always teach the right skills. Ability is a little different. Ability is kind of like what your natural traits are. Sometimes your personality traits will determine kind of what you're good at and what you're not good at, right? And so, it's true that 10,000 hours is what it takes to be an expert in anything, right? But you really have to have the I call it abilities, but you call it attributes. You have to really like it to spend 10,000 hours doing it. And you have to, you know, just obviously you don't have like arms and legs. It's hard to play a guitar kind of thing, right? You know, have some of the minimum abilities, but that personality trait is really super important. And trait-based kind of testing is not how we do things. You know, when I was at DARPA, you know, with one of the problems is what's the next generation soldier? You know, I always say, you know, Steve Rogers before he became Captain America, you know, back in the day, you could tell who's the best soldier, who's going to run 13 miles, 100 pounds on their back, right? Kind of thing. These days, most soldiers don't run 13 miles with 100 pounds on their back. They're either mechanized vehicles or they're, you know, flying drones back in the US and stuff like that. There's a lot more cognitive skills that are important. Right. And tracing abilities. And so, you know, and cognitive skills are a little bit harder to measure. We definitely measure with our own games and tests. Right. But they're not like visually, you know, I can't look at Nick and say, okay, is Nick super smart or it's not, right? You know, you just can't tell from a person's outside. Right. I mean, other than like, if you go into like the geek or nerd stereotypes, right. But, you know, is someone really capable, you know, you don't know. And I think that's the harder thing. And so a lot of the coaches I talk to at the elite level, that's what they did. The non-tangibles, right, are what they really focus on and trying to understand, do they have the desire, the will, the ability to go do this stuff, right? Not the skills, because they can get coached to skills. And I think the best example is that's Tom Brady. Because you look at Tom Brady when he went for the NFL Combine, he ranked last at every quarterback statistic. Every way you could measure a quarterback, he was last at, right? But there was something in Tom Brady that just wouldn't let him quit. He had desire. He was going to do those 10,000 hours. He's going to be an expert at it, right? And he's going to try hard. A lot of people who were already gifted didn't try that hard, right? Or didn't care as much. And so I think Steve Mariucci said he wished he could break open his heart and look to see what's inside, right? And so, you know, I think that that drive is something that is inherent. And I think it's inherent to everyone, depending on the field. Like I might be super driven in, you know, AI, but other people may be driven in cooking or anything like that. And trying to link up what you have the ability or desire to do, again, with the someone to teach you the skills, I think you'll succeed. And I think that's a big part of being successful, not just like, but, you know, today's society, it's all about, you know, are you next LeBron James? Are you genetically gifted, right? Kind of thing, you know? And so that's the balance I learned and those things of good performance is, you know, desire is a huge component and desire will build into you doing what it takes to do the 10,000 hours.
Yeah. And one of my big fears growing up was that I'd get about 9,000 hours into something and realize that it just wasn't for me. Do you have any tips for someone earlier in their career to figure out what they should be focusing on for 10,000 hours or longer?
Well, the thing is, you know, people try to do this with their kids when they're too young, but because, you know, the kid doesn't need to be at 12 different activities, right? But your kid be a kid sometimes. But I think when you're in college, I think college is the one time you're actually with a bunch of people who are different than you. There's different colleges, different schools, different things like that. And after you graduate from college, you're with, you've chosen a career and everyone around you is like you, right? Kind of thing. They're all doctors or lawyers or whatever the career field is, right? Engineers. And so at that time, try everything. Meet as many people as you want, get different perspectives, right? Try different things. And a lot of it is talking to other people and seeing, you know, who have done the 10,000 hours, you know, understanding really the commitment. Everyone likes to be Michael Phelps, but no one, during the Olympics when he wins the gold, no one wants to be Michael Phelps as an 11-year-old at 5 a.m. in the morning, swimming, you know, for an hour and a half.
I'd say no one wants to be outside of the Olympics because that's so much. They don't realize about the training, the mental, the physical, the emotional that's going on behind the scenes and how it's all consuming.
Right. And the thing is, you know, and as you said, as you're younger, you know, when you look at what it really takes to be successful, right? And you have to ask yourself, am I willing to go do that? Do I like this enough to go do that? And the answer is, I'm not sure I like it that much to go do that work, right? Then you kind of get your answer what you want. And you can try it out and see how hard it is, how much you like it. But I think that's the first question. It's like, realize what it really takes to be successful. Now, everyone thinks there's an overnight success thing or, you know, you wake up one morning and you're a superstar or something like that, right? There's a ton of work involved. And if you like the work, you'll be successful, right? If you hate the work, no matter what you do, you know, like if your parents force you into a career that you just hate, you're never going to be successful at it, right? You'll eventually fail out and do whatever you like to do, right? So finding that thing is important and really understanding what it takes. Because people get, you know, fascinated by the gold medals, like you said, you know, fascinated by the fame and the glory. They want to be that, but they don't realize how much effort it takes to do it, right?
One other thing around desire, I think there's a misconception that this type of person, this quarterback, this celebrity has just this extreme passion. That's just who they are. But the thing is, if you take them to other areas of life, other disciplines, they probably won't have that same passion. They'll be just like you or I. So it's really tapping into yourself and figuring out what draws out your inner desire, your curiosity, your growth.
You know, not everyone's good at everything. And I think there's a lot of people who put pressure on themselves to be good at everything, right? Yeah. And it's again, it's a waste of calories. I think a life of efficiency is probably the best. You don't eat foods that cause you to be sick. You don't let things kind of distract you from what you're trying to do. And, you know, you don't work on something that you're not committed to, right? Just because it makes you look good or it makes someone happy. It's like, to really be successful, focus on one thing, focus on what you really desire to do, your purpose, your calling in life, right? Kind of thing. And if you do that one thing, it helps a ton in regards to making you feel better about what you're doing. And feel like the sacrifices are worth it, right? Yeah. That's the thing. It's like, you know, to do anything. Life sucks. You're getting kicked, you know, down, you know, things people can tell you all sorts of bad things about you, right? Like Tom Brady, oh my gosh, can you imagine him in draft night, you know, everyone telling him he sucks and he's, you know, sixth round in the draft and, you know, five quarterbacks ahead of him, stuff like that, you know? And, but, you know, if you really like it and you think you can be really good at it, right, and you really want to work hard at it, right, then it doesn't matter what people say. And that kind of gives you kind of the fortitude to keep going, I think.
Yeah, because there's ups and downs along every journey. Yep. And those downs can feel a lot worse when you're in them than they do in hindsight. But right, it's what are you willing to persist through? And that will help you help dictate what you should pursue.
Absolutely. I mean, like you said, you know, if you don't like it enough, like if you don't like your girlfriend enough to go through a bad time, then you probably shouldn't be with her. If you're, you don't like a job and or anything to go through a bad time, then don't be at that job, right?
Yeah.
You have control of your life. You can go change the parameters, right? You always have a next day to go forward. But so it doesn't make sense to do things you don't like or you won't persevere through when things go bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of parameters, tell me about some of the AI behind Amplio and the technology that sets it apart from so many other devices, apps on the market that all help optimize performance.
Well, the first thing we do that other people don't do is we don't do population studies. And so we learned early on when we work with long distance runners in Colorado that, you know, this guy said, I'm 6'4" and she's 5'3" trunk. I can't run like her. Right. You know, different body dimorphisms. And so there was no one way to run. Right. If your legs are longer than my legs, you can't run like me. We can't have the same gait. We can't have the same stride. And so when a lot of people do, like, you know, big population studies on sleep and stuff like that and say the average is this is the way it works, you know, then who's average? Who's the best way to run? And so we build ours only on individuals' data. That's how we personalize it to you. We try to see how you look in regards to your baseline and try to learn what Nick is on a constant basis, right? We want to learn when Nick is happy, when Nick is sad, and, you know, or not performing well. Sad is probably a better word. And say, okay, what are his measurements? What's his body telling us, right? What's he signaling? What's the signaling to us when he is not doing as well, right? What's the signaling to us when he does really well? And then say, okay, these are the areas he needs to work on, right? And you know, it takes a little bit of time. It takes about 4 weeks to truly personalize it for you. But the idea is that, you know, we just want to listen to you and your data. And wearables give us a great opportunity to do that because they give us so much data. I mean, data is being collected in 1 second increments on you all the time from your wearable device, right?
And it's hands off too.
It's totally hands off. And so it's not something you have to, you know, worry about turning on or turning off. And so we get tons of data on you and we can just work off of you and look at, you know, how changes to your baselines occur. And like I say, you know, with the whole, what makes Nick perform well, what doesn't make Nick perform well is what they call causal model in AI. And again, we're looking at probability distributions, right? So we want to see how many times you actually perform well, how many times you didn't, and look at what the component factors are that we're measuring. I said, this is what is the characterization of Nick when he's doing well, this characterization of Nick within a probability distribution. And then we say, okay, if I change this factor, what's the probability that Nick will get to where he wants to be? He's here today and he needs to be here tomorrow, right? What can we do today to kind of get Nick there, right? And that's how we kind of prepare people. That's how we're helping the baseball players prepare as they kind of get going to a game. You know, you never actually, you know, the funny thing that we actually learned from the players as well is, and we don't do, our AI doesn't tell you you're not ready, right? No one wants to hear before a game that they're not ready to go play or, you know, that they're not ready and they feel like, we were talking to someone who was using a wearable and he said his readiness score is low. But he's like, I feel fine. I'm on a marathon, right? You know, and now I feel like there's going to be something wrong with it, right?
That's the nocebo effect. So if I have a bad night of sleep, I wear the Oura Ring. If I sleep poorly, I will not check the score until later in that day because I know that if I check it in the morning and I see a terrible score, or if I even sleep well and I see a bad score, maybe the sensor is off a little bit and the data is just inaccurate, then I'll be in this negative mindset around my sleep the whole day. And I'll be like, I should be feeling tired because I only have a 50 sleep score. Right. Is that tiredness? Yeah, that is tiredness. Yeah. Okay, it makes sense. And then just like I'm implanting these ideas in my own mind that don't need to be there.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the one thing, you know, when AI used by other people just looks at patterns and gives you a score without any context, right?
Yeah.
For us, we're more focused on basically The second piece of AI that we work on is recommender system. Mm-hmm. It's trying to recommend things that you will actually do that actually help you get better, right? And it's showing a positive effect over time with you, right? Yeah. And so we want to recommend things that, you know, help you get better. And that's things like, you know, showing you a number, which is what a lot of people do, graphs and numbers, mm-hmm. has that placebo effect because everyone wants to be 100, right? Everyone wants to have really high scores. But, you know, if you're normally a 30 and you're a 50 today on that readiness meter, you're doing pretty good, Nick. You know what I mean? It depends on what 50 is for the general population and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
For you, normally, you're 30. So you should feel good about yourself. And you should. So it's more about trying to help you interpret information. Mm-hmm. I just tell you suck or this or that. You know, interpret information, what can I do to get better? You know, and do I need to do anything to get better, right? And that's, I think, more important than, you know, that's the third pressure AI is building that recommender so we can give you things that you can actually do and accomplish, right? And get you better. And a lot of that has to do with just understanding your preferences. Like if we give you a recommendation, you don't do it. You know, we're learning over time what you're really willing to do and how much effort you're going to put in.
To highlight what you said earlier about the differences between individuals, there's a great book that I think you'd like called Biochemical Individuality by Roger Williams. And he methodically goes through the entire body and shows how from one person, from one extreme to the next, there can be a 50-fold difference between people in like terms of enzymes, hormones, size, which in biology, size dictates function. So you can imagine if you're running a study and you see all these extremes on either side, and to make it meaningful, you average them away. And then all the nuance, all the individual difference between people is lost. But when in reality, it's possible that there wasn't a single person who was the average across the board.
Last thing, like when you look at the, just look at like what a middle income person is. When you actually see the graph, there's a lot of people on the poor side, a lot of people on the rich side. Yeah. And there's almost no one in the middle, right? And and that's exactly the thing that we worry about. It's like, you know, you lose a lot of that nuance and you really want to understand the individual. That's why we only build our models off of that. Now, we did averaging and stuff like that from a statistical standpoint because we're human beings mm-hmm. and we can't deal with a lot of individual little things, right? But that's why AI is good because, you know, our AI is specific to you. It doesn't know anyone else, right? And it's just trying to understand you and we can replicate that. And so instead of having 100 presidents, you know, for every, you know, person, a president for every person to kind of understand what they need, you know, and so they do these generalized things for the government, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we actually have an AI that literally only exists because you exist, right? If you don't give it data, it just doesn't do anything, right? And so from that standpoint, we really want just to listen to that individual, right? Because there are differences. And I think one of the shames of society today, especially with social media, is the whole comparison thing. Everyone's trying to compare themselves to someone else, right? And genetically, you may never be. I mean, I would love to be freaking LeBron James, but genetically, it's just not going to happen, right? I'm never going to be that tall. I'm not going to be able to shoot basketballs that well, right?
Yeah.
Why compare myself to him at all then? I'm not him, right? And we're all kind of uniquely gifted, I think. And like we talked about earlier, in what we desire and what we can be good at. And a lot of times we fail because we're comparing ourselves and we want to be like XYZ person. And we spend our whole lives feeling like we're a failure because we don't live up to a standard that doesn't make any sense.
I think what it is it. It's hard. There's no like objective measure of how we are doing. So we look around us at people who are considered role models and say, how do I stack up compared to them? Even though my body, my mind, my life, it's completely different, but still like, how can I approach their level of performance?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And the thing is that, you know, you may just need a different path, right? You know, you can't just follow the path he did because he's genetically gifted and whatever. You need a different path and it may take you longer, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you're doing it wrong, right? And that's the thing. It's like, that's why it's so important to listen to yourself and listen to your body and not worry about those comparisons. Like you said, you know, how do we get to objective measures? And that's what we're trying to give you, some objective measures, right? Yeah. But again, it should be on your baseline and what makes you better as opposed to what makes me better or anyone else, right? One of the Olympic athletes we talked to said, you know, Trung, whenever I go to a coach, he said, you need to do this because the last guy that did it was successful doing it. I always get mad. I'm like, why do you get mad? He's like, you know, well, I'm not that guy, right? You know, it was because his coach had asked him to put a bunch of muscle mass on, right? Get like bulk up and it threw off his skiing. because he was, you know, his weight was different than he's used to, and the way he kind of did angles, because it's all about angle or momentum, right? Where you shift your weights to control the skis. And so he did horribly, and then the coach had him cut a bunch of weight, right? Like, you know, and so he's like, you know, I don't do it just because someone else did it, right? Figure out what works for me and help me get better, right? And I think, you know, when elite athletes are saying that, right, we should all demand that, right, from everyone around us. I know it's easy to have one size fits all, but it's normally never helpful.
Yeah. Have you come across any unusual or surprising results from those beta testing Amplio?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was super interesting is that we were working with Cal Poly Pomona's track and field team. Mm-hmm. And one of their highly recruited runners, she wasn't performing the way they expected to. Actually, was getting worse week to week. And when Chris Bradford, who was the head coach, he's like, you know, normally, you know, we think it's kind of a motivation problem, make her run harder. But we had numbers, and the numbers said that, you know, her running mechanics looked good, so she knew how to run, right? You know, she seemed to be sleeping okay, but her testosterone got cut in half. And so when you're like, oh, you know, testosterone is just important for women as men. It's a 15X number. But testosterone is how your body recovers, how it rebuilds muscle, right? And she had been raised in a family that didn't drink a lot of caffeine and didn't have a lot of soda. And she went to college. Her going wild was drinking a ton of coffee and caffeine. And it just hammered her testosterone numbers, right? And so from that standpoint, you know, we said, okay, that's what's really wrong with her. So we had to get her a nutritionist and help her kind of figure out how to, you know, stay awake in class and stuff like that as she kind of went to the whole college scene. But I mean, it's surprising, like, you know, how little things can have a huge impact on you. Even if you're like, you know, the world's best runner or whatever, right? It's, you know, you're drinking too much caffeine. And it's so important to, like, you know, say, why do I feel tired all the time? Why aren't I getting stronger, recovering? And running is such a brutal sport. Yeah. It tears down the muscles and stuff like that. And so if she's not recovering, she would have been burnt out and quit or get hurt. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing.
It's a fast track to overtraining and then eventual burnout if you don't correct it.
Yeah. Or major injury.
Yeah. Right? Do you guys measure blood biomarkers too?
We do. I mean, we don't cover the cost of the test. Mm. So we have the Major League Baseball players, they pay for a $3,000, 30-page blood test. We can go all the way down to what we did with Cal Poly, which is a finger prick test with a ZRT labs. But you can do like B-Well. There are a number of places that take little blood markers for you, right? Mm.
Do you guys allow like users to import the results into the app?
Yeah, they can do that. Okay. And, you know, from that standpoint, now we'll track that, and we want to get the overall picture. Like a readiness score is usually based off something called HRV, heart rate variation, but heart rate variation is the effect, not a cause. So it could be because, like in her case, it was low because of her nutrition, right? Mm-hmm. It could be because she overtrained the other day. It could be because she didn't sleep well. You have to start knocking all those things off, right, to really get to what's wrong. Otherwise, you're trying to fix the wrong problem.
Yeah.
Right. Like I said, you know, have her run more, right? You know, maybe that's not the answer to the problem. Yeah. So that's the idea.
Okay. Let's start to wind down. I have a couple more questions for you before we get to the rapid fire round.
Sure. Not a problem.
You've clearly absorbed a lot of different information and knowledge from different domains. And I know that from reading a research paper put out by DARPA, that there's certain technologies, like one called cranial electric stimulation, where you put electrodes in different parts of the, I guess in this case, actually shoulder and the temple, and it can increase like the ability to learn the speed by like up to 30 or 40%. So have you found anything like that, that any techniques or processes that you use to learn faster?
It used to be called the Genius Program when I was at DARPA. The reason why they do this is a big nerve here. It has a billion nerves in the bundle, and they shock the entire thing. And they don't know exactly which nerve stimulates the learning, but it happens to stimulate learning, right, kind of thing. And I think, you know, we were doing testing in at Tufts with the Army Performance Lab with shock belts. And sometimes, you know, people build up resistance to it. Uh-huh. And you have to kind of keep increasing the shock. We're trying to reduce stress, right? and they eventually start burning themselves. Right. Wow. And so I'm like, you know, worried a little bit that, you know, you're shocking your vagal nerve and, you know, and your body starting to get used to it because your body adapts and compensates. Right.
Yeah. The one I was thinking of is just like a very small microcurrent of like 1 milliamp. So it's like very low, like less than a battery.
No, I agree with that. Yeah. But eventually, you know, if you get used to it, do you bring it up to 2 milliamps? You build up 10 milliamps, still get the same effect. Because if you do it longitudinally over time, you're going to get used to it eventually. And that's what I worry about a little bit. I'm not talking about thousands of volts on your vagal nerve, no, but you know, I don't know what the effect, the long-term effect of burning it out is. I think, you know, from a standpoint of how to learn faster, is to learn from other people. Mm. You know, I think the thing is, you know, if you want to learn like a different career, different things, be open to talking to people, how they do it, right? And learning from them and not repeating their mistakes. Now, a lot of people say, hey, you know, I'm going to learn, but I'm going to start running on my own and figuring this stuff out myself and reading a ton of books. You know, getting a coach would be good, or getting a friend that likes running. And you kind of learn. Doesn't mean you have to emulate them or do exactly what they say, but at least you can avoid some of the downs and ups. I mean, downs that they'll cause you problems, and it'll make you better faster, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's why teams are so important. Like when you in high school or things like that, you're running with a group of people and you see a variety of different things and you can learn from a variety of different people. All that really increases learning, right? And quite a bit.
You get ideas of what does work for other people and you can try it out yourself and see if it works equally as well for you.
Yeah, because if you think about it, you know, sadly, most of life is trial and error, mm-hmm. right? We weren't born with the innate sense of this is what you need to be healthy and be a superstar, Nick, yeah. You know, kind of thing. No, we all have to try different things and kind of learn. And so from that standpoint, my big example is always Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan didn't want to be a basketball player until I was like junior year in high school, right? Kind of thing. He turned out to be a pretty good basketball player, right? but the, you know, that's the question, right? You know, how do you learn from other people and your willingness to be exposed to different things?
Yeah. And I think it's also important to curate your information or who you look up to, like your role models, carefully, because if you're following the footsteps of someone, you don't realize they have this whole other side that actually permeates into everything they do, think, and say, you probably don't want to pursue that too closely.
No, absolutely right. I mean, I think it's a tough balance, right? Because a lot of people don't show all the sides of themselves to the real world, right? And so, you know, so it's hard. It's hard. But I think, you know, like you said, try it, right? You know, don't do it religiously just because, you know, XYZ did it, right? Kind of thing. You know, you're not going to be like Mike just because you wear Jordans, right? Kind of thing. You know, try out what works for you and be willing to say, okay, this is not working. Not say like, hey, I need to try harder to be more like Mike. Hey, what Mike's doing, I can't do, right? And I need to go find something else. So, and another role model or a different path, right? But that's the thing. Who says there's one path to anything?
Yeah.
Right? We can just kind of walk to the path that we need to walk on.
Mm-hmm. I heard a concept that I really like, and it's treating your life like a business. And by that, I mean, you establish a board of advisors for your life and different specialists for different things. And before you make any major decisions, you consult your board. Or if you don't have access to these people in reality, then you can just create like a virtual board of the most influential folks on your life. And then just like before you make a decision, think through how they would respond if they were here mentoring you.
No, that's actually a great idea. I think, you know, diversify that board.
Yeah.
Put you with different perspectives, right? Mm-hmm. So you get a balanced view. But I think that's a great idea. I think, you know, it's one of the things that helped us be successful. We have this very elite board of advisors, neuroscientists, behavioral psychologists, coaches, human performance experts, nutritionists. And they all have a different perspective, and listening to all of them really kind of helps me make decisions, right? Like I said, you know, I'm not good at all that stuff. I'm an AI guy. I build AI systems, right? And so, you know, and people have 30 years and top of their professions are kind of good at that stuff. So, you know, you want to listen to them.
They've gone well past the 10,000 hours.
Right, exactly.
Okay, well, say that you don't have these experts in your life, but you want to learn in other ways. Let's go on to the question I ask all guests, that if there was a burning of the books, all knowledge on earth is gone, but you get to save the three most impactful works on your life or career, what would you choose and why?
One book that I thought was super important when I was young was Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle. And what it did was, you know, it talks about the Manhattan Project and building a nuclear bomb. And the theme of the story was always, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. Right. And I think a lot of people just kind of missed that. The second thing in the book that I thought was really super impactful for me was, the first Lord of the Rings series. Right. And, you know, it kind of taught me is okay to dream. You can dream this whole fantasy world and everything you can do, and you can be a hero in your own story. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of neat. And then lastly, Stephen Hawking's book on the foundation of the universe is, and when he talks about string theory, right? And it's not so much about string theory and how the universe is done, is that there's more we don't know than we know.
Yeah.
Right. And it's better to be curious and keep asking questions, mm-hmm. right? Than it's to know things. If you haven't answered everything, you may not even have the right questions.
Yeah.
Right. And so those are the three books I would choose.
I like that. And I'm very careful about what beliefs and knowledge I hold so close that no amount of other information will break that. Like Walt Thornhill has a theory called the electric universe theory. And it talks about how gravity might not be all that we understand it. And there might be other like electrical forces that are bigger overarching that cause gravity to be a dominant force.
Right. No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think the idea of gravitons as being like, quantum particles and how they interact with the strong, weak force. I mean, I think there's so much we don't know, right? I mean, we hammer at things by breaking apart atoms and stuff like that. But, it's like the whole VO nerve thing. We know there's certain nerves that we do program correctly will help us learn all sorts of things, open our mind up. Sure, we only use 10% after all, right? But, we don't know which one of them are in the billion nerves in that bundle. And so we shocked the whole thing. And, that's like, it's like shocking the entire, line, telecommunication pipe between, the US and Europe. Right. And you're shocking all the cities there with the cell phone. And then you're not really sure which one you eventually get to the guy you want, but a lot of other people are getting impacted the same way, but it's a good program though. It's helping a lot of people with epilepsy and stuff like that. But the premise of being a long-term learning tool, I kind of question. I think they do too, I think there's a lot to think about in regards to truth. And that's why I don't believe in ground truth. That's why I don't believe in like these population maxims. And this is, true for everybody. I don't think there is a truth for everybody. So we have to see.
Okay. Let's go on to the lightning round now.
Okay.
Trung, what are you most interested in and researching these days?
How you actually measure emotions through like EEG and stuff like that. Working a lot with neuroscientists and reading neuroscience papers on you. So how do you actually see into the mind, right? Mm. Because I think that's the next really great domain that we need to go conquer. I think we understand how heart works, the lungs, even the liver, right? But the thing that controls most of everything is our mind, and we don't understand how that works at all. We're getting there. But, you have Alzheimer's patients and stuff like that. So all that work really fascinates me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's one thing that your tribe doesn't know about you?
Probably I'm a big gamer geek, right? I don't really talk to a lot of people about gaming, right? But and I'm one of those people that go solo. I don't do gatherings or teams, I guess, right? On online. So I'm always a solo player that joins the team at the end, right? From that standpoint, it's not that I'm unsociable. It's that I use gaming to relax. I'm not a serious gamer, right? If I don't do well, I'm okay, right? And so I'd rather, not impact too many people around me when I do that. But it's a fun hobby of mine that I probably spend way too much time playing, right? But it's helpful to relax and release, because the nice thing about games and is that you feel a sense of accomplishment when you're building a company or building big things, that take multi-years to do.
Yeah.
Not every day you feel like you accomplished something, right? And at least with a video game, you've done something, right?
The biggest opposition to my sleep throughout my entire life until I stopped playing was video games. So I get that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Are there any final parting words you'd like to leave my audience with?
Spend some time thinking how the pandemic affected you. A lot of us either want to pretend it didn't happen, right? Or, we think about it too much. But, just take an emotional assessment of like, what are you doing differently or what are you thinking about because the pandemic occurred, right? And really seriously take care of that, because I think, the worst thing you do for a trauma And you, psychology tells us all this time, right? Is suppress it, right? That's where PTSD comes from and all this other stuff, right? And you really don't want it coming out in at times when it's just not helpful, right? When you're in front of people or being with your kids, right? And so figure out, you know, how you feel, write it down and figure out coping strategies. I think, you know, it's okay. Like I said, it's okay during the pandemic to feel anxious and sad and depressed. The whole world feels a little anxious, sad, and depressed, right? You know, the question is how you cope with it. And I think that's what I like to leave your viewers with. I think, you know, we're definitely raising money on Republic.co. So if you want to invest in our company, we're there, Amplio.ai. But really take care of yourselves and really seriously take a good assessment of what the pandemic's done to you. I think that's super important.
And when you say dealing with the trauma, suppression is not a viable solution. I know that for most of my life, I did that. And when I started dissecting my behavior, why I said certain things, why I acted in certain ways, I dug way down through all the layers. I realized a lot of times it's because of something that I never addressed. And that by going back and addressing it and thinking through it, feeling it, like allowing myself to experience it again, then I was able to change that behavior, which would come out in seemingly random, non-connected ways.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you can't move forward unless you address kind of the holes in the bolt, right? Kind of thing. And it's not, I'm not saying you should have a whole breakdown about it, but I mean, certainly you should have like a good idea of like, you know, admit that it has impacted you, right? I think the denial is just not going to be helpful because like you said, even you deny what your body's doing, like we talk about emotions and you're denying your emotions or, you know, going with them, you know, it doesn't change the facts on the ground. It doesn't change the chemical capacity of your brain. It doesn't change how you're changing your pathways, make decisions, right? Your behaviors, right? So, I mean, you can ignore it all you want, but, you know, you have to address it eventually. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for your time. It's been great chatting today about the future of health, wellness, performance, how you and Amplio are individualizing things. And I can't wait to see where you guys go from here.
That sounds great. Thank you for having me on, Nick. I really appreciate the time.
I'm Nick Urban with Trung Tran of Amplio, signing out from mindbodypeak.com. Have a great week.
Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.